My name is Jennifer Huddleston, and I'm a Technology Policy Research Fellow here at the Cato Institute. I'm excited to be joined by a wonderful panel of experts today on this, the five-year anniversary of the enforcement date of the General Data Protection Rule, or GDPR, as it is more commonly known, which was a landmark European Union data privacy law that went into effect in May 2018. In the immediate aftermath of GDPR, we saw a lot of conversation around the impact this could have on the global data privacy debate, and particularly on the impact it might have on some of the US's leading technology companies, as well as smaller players both in Europe and in the US. We've seen debates over whether or not this actually improved data privacy, over the impact that it might have on other rights like speech and innovation, as well as questions about what this means for the overall debate and the US's role in technology policy. As I mentioned, I'm excited to be joined by a wonderful panel of experts today. Starting from my left, we have Nathan Linfors, who is with InGen. We have Lee Matheson from the Future of Privacy Forum. And then at the end of our panel, we have Brandon Pugh with R Street. So just to get started, Lee, can you give us a brief overview of what do you think we've seen most over the last 5 years when it comes to the way GDPR has impacted the debate of data privacy?
Well, for one, I think I would actually push back a little bit on the idea that 5 years ago marked some sort of fundamental seismic shift in the data privacy space. I mean, the underlying principles of the GDPR can be that you see set out in Article 5 with the, you know, principles of fairness and transparency, and the Article 6 lawful bases for processing, and the sort of rights that need to be guaranteed to data subjects in Chapter 2. This stuff wasn't invented out of whole cloth in 2012 when the GDPR was proposed, or even in 2016 when it was adopted. This stuff dates back to at least the Data Protection Directive of 96, and in many ways, I think, even earlier, to like the 1980 OECD FIPS that we all know and love so well. So that's not to say that the GDPR doesn't represent any sort of change. Certainly, it's a landmark piece of privacy regulation, and absolutely affected the operations of businesses all over the world in ways that the preceding laws maybe didn't. But I think it's important to note that it didn't just, you know, emerge out of a vacuum. And noting that, I think that there's also there should be a recognition that looking at the GDPR and looking at, you know, both before and since the GDPR, so many other international jurisdictions have adopted laws that are structured in a similar way. There's some sort of consumer policy drive that's being responded to by regulations that are structured in this way. It's, you know, not just technocratic policymakers pulling this stuff out of a hat. There's interest in people wanting to know what is done with their data, wanting to have rights about, you know, either requesting deletion, requesting access, requesting correction. You see variations in this model around the world, but there's a lot of fundamental structure that's the same. I'm going to look at my cheat sheet here. I think there's now 157 countries globally that have some sort of data protection law on the books, and many of them, including many of the most recent jurisdictions to adopt those laws, have structured those laws along GDPR lines, where you have principles-based obligations, you have particular individual obligations to individual data subjects, and then you have, you know, record keeping, data protection impact assessments, outlined roles and responsibilities for data protection officers. So I think, I guess, to answer what your original question was, the impact on businesses and the impact on other organizations that function as data controllers or processors is a formalization of what these roles and responsibilities are, as more and more people and more, you know, just out in the world and more organizations become aware that there are legal and regulatory obligations that go with processing personal data because the public demands that there be so. I think that's my initial take.
Great. Well, thank you very much. And you mentioned that there are 157 countries with data privacy laws. And one of those countries that's missing is the United States. We'll turn to that discussion in a bit. But before we do, I can't imagine if you're a small business looking to expand into an international market, those are a lot of different regulations to comply with. When GDPR first came on board, we saw a lot of questions about what this was going to do to competition, what the impact would be on the startup and small business sector. Nathan, I know you work directly with small businesses and with some of those smallest startups. What have you seen when it comes to the conversation around GDPR and small businesses and startups over the last 5 years?
Yeah, well, first, Jennifer, thanks so much to you and to the Cato Institute for holding this event today. Really excited to be here with my esteemed colleagues. And yes, as you say, Engine, we're a nonprofit based here in Washington, D.C. We work with government and a network of thousands of startups across the U.S. to promote pro-startup, pro-innovation, pro-entrepreneurship policy. And one of those policy areas that we work on a lot is smart digital trade policy. Make sure startups compete around the globe, and data privacy. Startups, to Lee's point, their users expect that their data is going to be protected and used in ways that they expect. And startups want to respect that. But at the same time, there's a lot of regulation and government that says how and the manner in which that occurs. And GDPR, I think, in many folks' minds, and especially those in operating in Europe, is kind of like the first kind of brought this to the fore in more recent times, though, as you say, not new. So let's just walk through like initial impact reactions from startups following GDPR's entry into force. Thousands of companies, large and small, left the EU market or used geo-blocking technology to prevent EU users from accessing their services. So we were just joking before this panel, you wrote an article and your friend in Europe couldn't read it because the newspaper wouldn't allow EU users, EU citizens to access their paper's website. But like while your LA Times and your West Elms of the world have gotten on just fine here in the aftermath, many startups haven't returned to Europe maybe shut down altogether. And in fact, GDPR induced exit of about a third of available apps in the app stores. You could argue that those are probably some of low quality and is probably a good result, but probably not all of them, right? And so there's some loss there. And the other side of this is some people like to insinuate that, oh, well, they left because they didn't want to comply with GDPR. I'd actually argue businesses want to comply. We kind of started our conversation there, but you know, the reactions really of leaving demonstrate that they want to comply because you know the economics, laboring under the risk of giant fines, you know the initial compliance cost of GDPR several hundred thousand dollars for startups to several million for larger organizations. Is just too much for you know maybe a startup that doesn't have enough users to justify spending those costs. So they leave or delay their entry. And I'll pause there so we can hear from Brandon.
Great. Brandon, I want to turn to you. I mentioned that one of those countries that does not yet have a data privacy law, at least on a federal level, is the United States. I think 5 years ago, there was a lot of optimism that we might see a U.S. response, something that would perhaps have a more free market or a less regulatory approach to data privacy. In the 5 years since then, we've seen data privacy laws emerge at a state level, and now it seems like we may have a new amount of momentum for a federal data privacy law. This, you know, in combination with the fact that we see in polling that data privacy kind of remains the technology policy issue that Americans are concerned about. And so I was wondering, what do you think U.S. policymakers can learn from 5 years of GDPR as they consider a U.S. federal data privacy law?
Well, Jennifer, thanks for having me, and of course, the Cato, too. Beautiful facility, by the way. I was just saying, I've long followed Cato, but I've actually never been to your headquarters here. So great to finally be here. But to your point, let me start on a positive note. I think GDPR did advance the privacy conversation. There's a lot of lessons learned from it. And I think it did definitely further the privacy field between the number of vendors and number of people working in it. So I think that's good. But it is not the perfect law by any means. And I'm routinely asked to this day, should we just implement the GDPR in America and that would be just the solution? My answer is no. Not to say there's not takeaways and key lessons learned that we couldn't adopt, but it ultimately is not the balance that I think, nor the Archery Institute thinks, is correct. And really what I mean by that is finding a balance between industry, consumers, and security. But to take a step back before I go into specific examples, I know some of the people in the audience are already experts, but just to set the framework of what we have now and maybe where we would go. To Jennifer's point, state action is happening at an incredible speed. Matter of fact, actually quicker than I had thought. Not only will we have 5 state laws either go into effect for the first time or update this year, we also see a number of state legislatures aggressively acting in them. It's very likely we'll see maybe 10 or more state-level laws passing or being in effect this year. Add to that the desire by federal regulators to act in this space. The Federal Trade Commission started their advance notice of proposed rulemaking with 95 questions, regulating everything from targeting advertising to security. I realize that may be scaled back or it may not go forward with all 95 questions, but that's still happening. Meanwhile, we don't have a federal standard. Congress is still, my view, is still very interested in it. We see tremendous momentum, especially last Congress with the American Data Privacy and Protection Act, or ADPPA, ADPA, however you'd like to say it. And it passed out of committee with 53-2 votes. There's very few pieces of legislation that can get that type of the support. Not to say it was perfect in every sense, but I think it was a significant step forward. And it really aimed at compromise. Like, I think there's no bill that's going to be perfect for everybody, but I think seeing where that middle ground is important. So as we move forward, what shouldn't we do that the GDPR did, or what lessons learned? I'll expand upon these as we go, but maybe just a few that stand out. I think ultimately, my view, maybe I'll sound a little cynical, with a lot of EU legislation is very regulatory and very enforcement heavy, and I don't think the GDPR is any exception. I think with the number of fines that have come out most recently with Meta the other day, which I know we'll get into, the goal should be to increase privacy, increase security, and increase just the general field, not to be a very regulatory enforcement heavy approach. And I think that is, in my view, the direction the GDPR has unfortunately went. And I think that's important because when we think of what is the enforcement mechanism in America, do we want to see 4% fines, or do we want to see something that's more modest, maybe to still deter the behavior or to penalize bad actors, but not necessarily shut them down? I also think that we need to be mindful to your point that there are businesses of various sizes. We like to just lump everybody into just massive companies, massive international corporations. Of course they exist, but we also have many small actors. So I think any legislation we need to do here, I think we should make it more nuanced to go after the fact that we have many small actors in this space, and their compliance capabilities may not be that average $1.1 million figure that we see often the case. Maybe 2 more points. Harmonization, that is key, especially for the U.S. I think any action we need, it should be one federal standard. That way we don't have this patchwork that I was alluding to before. I think that is really hurting businesses, and more importantly, it's hurting consumers, because more likely than not, you're in this room and you live in a state that doesn't have a state privacy law. Whereas in GDPR, many touted that as the uniform standard. Maybe some would disagree with me on this stage, but we've seen variations. We definitely see different levels of interest in enforcement actions. We've seen different interpretations. So I think that is something to be mindful of as an American standard rolls out. And something, of course, that's near and dear to me is security. Protecting the data once it is collected. GDPR does have a section. I actually think some of the more American proposals we've seen more recently have gotten the balance better. And why I say that is, if you looked at the draft legislation from last Congress, it alluded to the fact that not everybody has the same data privacy and data protection needs. You may have limited amount of information, but it may be very sensitive. But on the other hand, you may have a ton of information, but it not be very sensitive. You may have strong compliance and security programs in place already, but you may not have the capabilities. So those sound like just like legislative drafting considerations, but they are significant. And I think that's something to keep in mind as we move forward in the U.S.
Thank you so much. And before I turn to the questions I have for our panelists, I just want to give all of our panelists a brief moment if there's anything that someone else said that you want to respond on before we continue with our panel and our Q&A.
Yeah, well, I'll underscore what Brandon was just saying here on competitive impacts and disparate impacts on large and small companies. Just going back to GDPR, startups saw reductions in profit by more than 10%, while larger companies were relatively unaffected. That's a competitive impact. That's disparate between company size. And then a few other ongoing impacts. U.S. startups foregoing EU market altogether or delaying a lot longer. It's not just GDPR. I'd argue it's a regulatory environment writ large. Investment in startups with EU exposure has been negatively impacted. So just one example, there's a pretty innovative travel software startup in our network. They, among other things, help break down language barriers, help you have a better trip, et cetera, et cetera. But every investor meeting they take, they get asked not just about GDPR, but about things like the DSA and the coming AI Act, and that weighs on investors' minds. I think it shows that, but also they've struggled to raise from folks that are apprehensive about investing in folks with international, especially given the current international environment. And then final thing I want to say is that in relation especially to a national framework, right now I think we see GDPR as a standard, but not necessarily in the way that Lee was talking about with the Brussels effect. We also see it as a private standard. And what I mean by this is software as a service startups. This is startups that mostly sell to business software. Selling to large multinational businesses, just like a lot of startups, I think something like 60% of startups are B2B SaaS companies. They often have to complete a third-party risk assessment before they can, provide their services and actually win a contract. And oftentimes, large multinational companies, because they have EU exposure or might use the software there, they base their, or even if they don't, they base their third-party risk assessment upon elements of the GDPR. And because U.S. startups aren't necessarily familiar with this, if they haven't operated in the EU before or thought about this thing called GDPR before, this can be a significant barrier. They lose out on opportunities, or they spend a lot of time and resources, up to something like 20% of the contract, usually 10 to 15%, but the highest number. And in our latest survey of our startups was 20% of a contract on these costs. So I think that could be solved by a national standard here in the U.S. From both directions. One, the large companies would have a U.S. standard to look to, and startups would be familiar with it. So just a plus one for a U.S. Uniform federal privacy standard.
Yeah. I'd like to interject there on the end of that too, at the risk of sounding like a repetitive demagogue, I guess. I think that you can look at the development, particularly of the patchwork, as you've referred to it. We love talking about the patchwork. My colleague Keir Lamont has done a lot of work tracking the development of state privacy legislation as the federal government continues to do or not do its thing.
Although I know he hates the term patchwork. He's like, it's way overused. So when I say it, I think of Keir. I'm like, I don't even hate this. Sorry.
Yes. But, the reason that that's happening is the underlying demand from, voters. Politicians wouldn't be interested in regulating in this space if the public wasn't interested in regulating in this space. And if the choice is between the patchwork, if that's what we're going to call it, or effectively, aside from whether or not you're captured by a sectoral federal law, no rules, it seems like legislators are willing to jump into the mix as long as, the federal legislative lawmaking process remains stuck. I think similarly, federal regulators are relying on rulemaking authority for the same reasons. I can't speak for the FTC, but if you made me guess, I'd say that they would prefer to have a new federal law that laid out more specifically and more recently their rulemaking authority in this area, and maybe provided them with some more resources. But, we don't have that yet. So now we have the, basically the process that you described happening. And similarly, to address some of what you said about the post-enforceability effect of the GDPR on, I guess, the SaaS community and particularly the startup community, many of which I think it's worth noting are, you know, mobile application service providers or something like that. You noted it was something like a third had fallen out of major mobile application distribution entities. One of the things that happened after the GDPR became enforceable was also that the developer terms for both the Google Play Store and the Apple App Store changed, and there was likely more private interest in requiring entities that had posted things to the store to comply with the terms that had previously existed. Prior to my role at FPF, I was in private practice, and I can tell you that when we were doing compliance work with entities that were interested in that sort of business, there was a significant change in what the view of the platforms themselves was, like the Google Play Store and the Apple App Stores of the world, and their relationship to entities listing their products on those stores. So I don't know if we're looking at a phenomenon that's solely just like the iron fist of the regulatory apparatus crushing innovation on the internet. There has to be some kind of middle ground in terms of the regulatory space. I'm no means up here as a GDPR evangelist claiming that it has, you know, no problems and there hasn't been any issues since the regulation became enforceable. There are a number of things that we can talk about later on that front, but I think it's the most important thing that I would look at is the underlying public demand for something like what it does, I think also driving the Brussels effect that you referred to, the adoption of GDPR-like laws in other jurisdictions. That wouldn't be happening if, you know, it's not purely, I think, for the ease of pursuing adequacy findings from the EU Commission, although that is undoubtedly part of the consideration. It's also because that's a model that has proven at least somewhat predictable in how it functions from a regulatory perspective.
As I say, I want to bring Brandon into this conversation before we turn to some very interesting questions that will dig deeper into some of these issues as well.
No, and I'll be quick because I know we'll get to it later. I would say this really underscores the need for the U.S. to take action now, because absent that, I don't blame many companies for voluntarily following the GDPR. It's a strict standard, and chances are it's going to meet a lot of other international frameworks. The unfortunate is it's not a pro-innovation and American view on how tech and privacy should be regulated. My personal take. At the same time, that's also the reason why we see federal regulators acting, because we don't have a standard. So I would prefer to see Congress in the driver's seat setting forth like what an American vision on privacy looks like, rather than the EU dictating what American companies follow and almost all cases, and in a federal agency taking step forward. Not to say there's not a role for the FTC. Like, I think they definitely have a role, but I think Congress should be dictating where their role is. And I think we saw that with some of these, you know, the ADPPA last Congress. Congress gave them lanes to do rulemaking in and kind of said, we'll act on security, help flesh out these other areas. I think that's phenomenal. Congress sets the vision, an agency provides expertise in line with Congress, and there can be some oversight.
One second, jump in here before you, Jennifer. I think that's exactly the middle ground that Lee was talking about, right? Is it's not so much GDPR's fault as the vacuum of a U.S. standard, in my view, and I think for a lot of startups as well.
So we've seen this debate over, you know, the Brussels effect and European standards versus American standards in a number of tech policy issues, some of which actually do intersect with the GDPR and the data privacy debate as well. I'm thinking about some of the very exciting technological innovations that we've really seen take off over the last 5 years. I know in 2018, we were seeing conversations about, can blockchain comply with GDPR? But in the 5 years since then, and particularly in the last year, we've seen this rapid emergence of artificial intelligence, and particularly of generative AI, and some new questions raised around that. I know there were a lot of concerns about, could ChatGPT comply with GDPR? I was curious, what are your thoughts on the way that some of these disruptive technologies may be impacted by GDPR? And on that underlying question of things like, can AI comply with these European standards?
I guess I'll jump in first. For some of the newest stuff, I mean, if we're talking about ChatGPT or its contemporaries and other large language models or other foundation models, it sort of remains to be seen exactly what the technical solutions are for enabling compliance with something like the GDPR, with consumer rights like the right to be forgotten, interacting with, you know, a massive training data set that may include personal information, and like, how does one go about implementing, you know, unlearning something that a model has learned after a data subject submits a valid write or request for deletion. But I would caution everyone from thinking that the sky is immediately falling. I mean, there is a risk assessment model built into the GDPR based on the purposes of processing. There's a process in place for determining, you know, what types of processing based on their purposes qualify as high risk, what sorts of documentation is necessary, what sort of transparency and disclosure options are necessary. I do think we run into more difficult territory when we're talking about providing meaningful information about the logic involved, for example, which is a transparency obligation for automated decision making under the GDPR, and what that means when we're talking about, you know, LLMs like ChatGPT, where we might not necessarily be able to do that in a way that's, you know, human intelligible. That sort of black box problem is not new to LLMs, though. A lot of AI tools and AI implementations have that issue generally. And frankly, I think that's a problem to steal from an argument that a colleague, Omer Tenay of mine, made a couple of days ago. AI is not just a privacy problem. I mean, there's a bigger issue here where the purposes and the functions of these tools, I mean, there's competition issues, there's, I guess, like, issues of the effect on basic democratic principles in terms of the availability of misinformation versus interest in preserving free speech rights. So for these new technologies, I don't think it's just a privacy thing. I do think that as my friend here alluded to earlier, the GDPR is not the only thing to look at in terms of the regulatory environment for AI technologies, particularly foundation models or other large language models. There's also the forthcoming AI Act. Depending on the scale of the entities that are putting these tools into market, they may be subject to the Digital Services Act or the Digital Markets Act in the EU. And you may see similar attempts, I think, emerge around the world to similarly, specially, I guess, put in a special regulatory category entities operating at a certain scale, which I think is probably the if you break it, if you get really reductive about what the DMA and the DSA are doing, you know, when you have these gatekeeper entities or these very large online platforms, like, that's the thought behind that from a regulatory process, is that you're in a separate space once you're dealing with the data of 45 million EU residents than other entities in the market, which, to both of my colleagues up here's points, is a recognition that, you know, there's a difference between a mom and pop SME and one of the largest tech companies in the world in terms of what their relationship to regulators and governments should be. So that's a long-winded way of saying, I guess, it depends, as we lawyers love to say.
I would like to actually expand this question a little bit, too, for our other two panelists. You know, there's an interesting phenomenon where while we have these data privacy-specific laws and regulations like GDPR, we also see various data privacy or data security regulations pop up in kind of other places. And sometimes it seems like there could be potential conflicts between this. I'm thinking of something in Europe like the Digital Market Act's requirements with GDPR. But we've also seen this with proposals in the US of questions of, can state laws comply with each other? How different state laws may comply with GDPR, how different regulations proposed around topics like online content or youth online safety or AI may impact data privacy of individuals as well. I was wondering if Brandon or Nathan, I'll turn to you first, if you could speak a little bit of how do companies and consumers consider those potential conflicts, and do you think there are potential conflicts between things like the DMA and the GDPR?
I don't have much to say on conflicts, but in terms of the overall kind of landscape, we touched on this earlier. I think just startups are nervous, and investors in startups are nervous. And I think when it comes to learning from consequences of GDPR, which may be why we call this like GDPR at five, right? I think some of the European policymaking might be continuing a pattern of not unintended consequences, but maybe disregarded consequences for startups in particular when it comes to tech policy. So, you know, last year startups saw this in the DSA. So the DSA burdens startups with obligations that today's incumbents never shouldered at that stage. Things like transparency reports, user appeals, and facilitating that those and more. Not saying that they shouldn't have to figure that out. Perhaps they should, but comparison for size, we talk a lot about disparate impact between large companies and small companies. Comparison for size, Facebook first released a transparency report in 2013. It was worth $139 billion then. It first allowed users to appeal removals of photos, videos, and posts in 2018. It was worth $374 billion then and had 35,000 employees. A startup with 50 employees, which is every startup large enough to offer user-generated content hosting in Europe, has to do that and more under the GDPA, under DSA. So like GDPR, there's going to be some disparate and some competitive impacts here when we think about startup success in the European market, particularly for US startups. This is going to be a barrier increase in kind of the continuing the pattern we saw with GDPR and maybe we might see with the AI Act as well. But Brandon, answer her question more directly.
No, it's not
complex.
I actually have answers to both, and I'll try not to make this a monologue here. But let me first start with AI, and I say this knowing my colleague who is a true AI expert is in the room, Adam Thier. But let me nevertheless copy him anyway. So I would say something I push back with AI a lot is AI is not a new technology. It's been around for years. Matter of fact, we use it on a daily basis. I use it really just to get here using Apple Maps and Google Maps. I think it's gotten a lot more prominence now because generative AI is part of the conversation, like these chatbots that we're seeing. That's the reason. And secondly, I also push back, not saying that either one of my colleagues here said this, push back against the notion that it's like a wild west and there's nothing. There has been a lot of great studies and a lot of great research put into AI governance already, both on the corporate side, corporations voluntarily studying this and holding themselves out to standards, as well as different trade associations and nonprofits have also put that out there. And then most recently with NIST. NIST has done a phenomenal framework around AI, building on their privacy and their cybersecurity framework. So there is, it's not like we have nothing out there. And I think that's a notion that a lot of people are unfortunately taking, is, you know, whether it be on the Hill or in the media. And I think that leads to the point that between GDPR and whatever the United States does, we do need to take into account innovation. And both ADPPA and GDPR, they call them different things, but they essentially have different reasons and different bases for collecting data. And that's really key to make sure that whatever we do in this legislation is not hampering innovation of tomorrow. We may not know about a future need. I'm not saying we don't have any guardrails around data and its collection, use, and sale, but I would hate to see technology and business practices hampered because of something that is very rigid. To your most immediate question, there are exceptions, but generally, if I had to characterize a lot of the EU action, I would say it's very regulatory-based, very enforcement-heavy, and generally produces less innovation. There's definitely exceptions to that, and I think, like I tried to start with, there's benefits to GDPR. But I would say to take the Digital Markets Act in particular to connect it to cybersecurity, because that's ultimately where I spend a lot of my research interests, there has been definitely cybersecurity concerns around that. A lot of it has been couched in the sense of, like, let's promote competition. But along with some of the specific provisions, which you can get into if there's interest, they lead to data potentially being disclosed. It leads to hampered cybersecurity practices. So those are things that we don't necessarily think of. And I like to think, even like antitrust action in the U.S., I don't think that's the intended goal ever. But we do need to be thinking through these unintended consequences.
So one day earlier this week, I opened Twitter, and in my trending was hashtag GDPR. As much as I would love to believe that that was because this event had so much desired attention on it, the reason that hashtag GDPR was in fact trending was the announcement of what is the largest fine to date in an action against Meta, or more commonly known as Facebook, that was both a retroactive fine that was the largest fine that we've seen, but also has many other questions raised, particularly around the status of EU-US data flows. We've seen in the 5 years since GDPR the death of what was known as Privacy Shield, which had was what had allowed a lot of these data flows to occur in the past. We've seen an executive order that seems to attempt to remedy this situation, but we're now in this kind of point of uncertainty, and particularly given this most recent action, I was wondering if our panelists could speak a little bit about what, if any, concerns are there currently about the ability of US-EU data flows for companies of all sizes, and what, if any, framework is needed in that regard?
Well, this is a subject that's near and dear to my heart, so I can at least start us off. For one, I'm going to shamelessly plug some of our own work here. We actually, earlier this year, published a comparative report looking at one of the main transfer tools in this space, specifically the transfer tool that the recent enforcement action against Meta found their use of to be invalid, which was comparing the EU's standard contractual clauses with other contractual documents that had been put forward by other regional entities, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations and the Ibero-American Data Protection Network. Also both have model data transfer contract clauses. But I guess to set the stage for this discussion a little bit here, I think really underlying this long-running series of enforcement actions and lawsuits about lack of enforcement actions and decisions by the CJEU is there are two fundamental disagreements that are happening. One, there's a disagreement between the EU and the United States as to whether or not the United States' laws permitting government access to personal information held by U.S. companies meet the necessary and proportionate language that is required by EU data protection law, and ultimately, according to the CJEU, the European Charter of Fundamental Rights, and then also within the EU, whether or not the same is the case. I mean, you have, I would say, not even Privacy Shield is the first step. You go back to the one that we always forget about, the Safe Harbor Agreement. Everyone says the new data privacy framework is Privacy Shield 2, and no, I think it's Safe Harbor 3. and this predates the GDPR significantly. I mean, the first, if we call them the Schrems cases after Max Schrems of NOIB, the first lawsuit predates GDPR. It goes back to allegations that still against Facebook, but that transfers to the United States violated obligations under the Data Protection Directive. And that's what brought down the Safe Harbor Agreement, and then its predecessor, Privacy Shield, now this new one. You know, I've been, and me and my colleagues have been plugged in at various levels of the just sort of ongoing negotiations around the new DPF. And the fundamental objections that the CJEU had, if you boil them all the way down, kind of deal with, one, whether or not U.S. Government access to personal information is necessary and proportionate, and two, whether or not there is a right of redress available to EU citizens that they need to have per the Charter and per the GDPR, and whether or not the new executive order and its accompanying Department of Justice regulations creating the Data Protection Review Court will satisfy that, I think, is an open question. I think we already know that given that there's been a draft of an adequacy decision already promulgated by the Commission for comment, it's likely there will be a finalized adequacy decision based on what the steps the United States has taken, and that as soon as that happens, there will be another lawsuit by NYOB. Mm-hmm. So the real decision will happen after that complaint and subsequent suits and the whole procedure is followed, and we get back in front of the Court of Justice in the European Union. And the real test will be whether or not that body thinks that the changes from where we were with the Privacy Shield and the Ombudsman that sat in state and the procedure that was available then versus what has been established now is sufficient.
Do you want to go first?
Sure. I'll just to add to what you're saying and to paraphrase James Carville, it's the spying stupid. Like with the recent Meta case, for example, I think, you know, elements of the U.S. national security apparatus are mentioned like 200 times, and FISA 702 is almost half of that. U.S. surveillance, as you just alluded to, contributed to the downfall of Privacy Shield and Safe Harbor for that. It's going to be at issue when Schrems challenges the DPF later this year, and then when that works through over the next several years. Section 702 is up for reauthorization this year. So to answer what policymakers maybe can do, maybe this is an opportunity to satisfy some of the not only the civil liberties kind of concerns that civil liberties community has, but perhaps also kind of the secondary trade impacts that we see. And it's really, really important to solve for startups, whether it's through, you know, the DPF being put into place so that there's a legal transfer mechanism that can be relied upon by startups to facilitate US-EU trade. You know, something like 70% of the Privacy Shield participants were small and medium-sized enterprises. And startups face a lot of costs after, you know, July 2020, when Privacy Shield was invalidated. They had to change to standard contractual clauses. They lost contracts and clients in the meantime. And SECs aren't exactly cheap to facilitate. So I'd say, you know, for folks, lose my directions here. For folks up there that care about entrepreneurship, care about startups, folks in the Commerce Department need to be, you know, working with their EU colleagues to make sure that the adequacy decision and the DPF is put into place as soon as possible. But there's a role for Congress to play here too, whether that's with 702 or other putting those mechanisms in EU in US law in other ways than through an EO.
Yeah, and I would say, unfortunately, it does seem like we're in this reoccurring cycle where we find a solution, then it's challenged, then it goes away, then we find another one, challenged, it goes away. It's this never-ending cycle. I do think that's ultimately bad for business, and that's the problem, is there's limited certainty, even especially where we are now. Like, I think it really starts the clock to finalize this process, because we could see a very real scenario then a period of months where data flows just stop. Like, I know a lot of people say maybe I'm an alarmist on data localization, some of the threats around there, but that's a real risk. And to the points that Nathan shared earlier, like, there's a risk that maybe companies will just stop doing business in certain areas or just have an entirely different business model. It'll become a specific product for one company, or one country, rather. And I would say, like, I'm not saying this is easy to solve. I mean, look at the 702 alone in the U.S. There are so many different opinions around how that should play. On one hand, we want to completely stop 702, have it not even be an investigative tool. On the other hand, let's just keep it as it is and maybe even make it even have more ability. And then there's this, you know, hybrid, maybe keep it but reform it in some modest ways. And we don't have agreement on there. So it's not surprising that the EU looking into our apparatus here would be questioning that. And a fair point, and this is a criticism I actually hear a lot by EU colleagues, is that you don't even have a U.S. data privacy law. So how are you in a position to tell us that you're adequately, you know, protecting data? I know a lot of the concerns are more on the national security side, and they're kind of maybe conflating the two, but it is a valid critique.
To build on Brandon's point there, I think that there is a significant element of that, particularly in if we just look at the statement released by the European Parliament last week, I think, as they came to lots of busy things happening in that body. They also came to their compromise text for their version of the AI Act for trilogue negotiations. But talking about potential adequacy and U.S. actions in relation to this sort of ongoing data transfer problem, one of the things that they cited as a concern was the lack of a U.S. federal data privacy law. Now, even if Congress passed something like that, that wouldn't likely also contain 702 amendments and what goes on with other core national security authorities like EO 12333 is up to the White House. But I think, yeah, it's not something that we can ignore as far as domestic policy in this country goes and our relationship to not just the EU, but increasingly other countries you know, I don't know if this is a next year problem or a 5 years down the line problem or a 10 years down the line problem, but a lot of other countries that have Brussels affected their way into a national data protection law that looks like the GDPR and contains cross-border transfer restrictions or requirements that other jurisdictions be assessed on the basis of adequacy or essential equivalency or whatever the phrase of the day is, I mean, that may start coming up. You know, it's not just a transatlantic question. There are a lot of jurisdictions, particularly a lot of growing major economies in the global south. You know, for example, the LGPD in Brazil, huge, you know, the largest economy in South America. There is a similar provision. Other economies elsewhere, in Southeast Asia and Africa, those jurisdictions are adopting similar data protection rules, and those concerns are not going to evaporate.
I know there are plenty of things we could still talk about. We haven't even gotten into, you know, half of the questions of trade-offs with these kind of regulations or things like that. But I do want to bring our audience into the conversation, both online and here in person. If you're joining us online, you can join the conversation and submit questions for our panelists either directly on the event webpage, Facebook, and YouTube, or on Twitter using the hashtag Cato Technology. And while if you are here in person, if you'll raise your hand, we do have a microphone going around so that those people online, as well as our panelists, will be able to hear you. But I'm going to start with a question from online. This comes from Will via social media. And I think it's a good reminder of the consumer experience of GDPR. Has anyone estimated how many hours, days, or years humanity has lost clicking through GDPR notices like cookie pop-ups? I ask this, I don't expect any of our panelists to necessarily have a calculation, although I'm very interested if they do. But for some people who might not be as familiar with the kind of legal questions we've raised about GDPR or the policy questions, what has the average American consumer experience of GDPR over the last 5 years?
I have a fun, possibly apocryphal answer to this question. It references what is now a number of years old, but a Carnegie Mellon paper that, and I'm pulling this off the top of my head, so please don't burn me at the stake if I'm wrong. But there was an attempt to calculate the amount of time that it would take to actually read at an average reading speed of all of the terms of service agreements and privacy notices that the average American interacts with over the course of a year. And it was something like 16 full 40-hour weeks. It was something ridiculous. And I think that demonstrates, I mean, there is a question, for one, to the cookie notices question. That's several regulations interacting. That's GDPR, that's the e-privacy directive, which may one day be replaced by the e-privacy regulation. Who knows? But there's a question of, like, are the privacy notices for every consumer, or are they for consumer advocacy groups and nonprofits, and if someone is curious about something that is happening, the ability to go back and look at a disclosure that affects them. You know, I will fully admit, as a person who's done privacy work as a legal professional for my entire career, I don't read most privacy notices and most terms of service agreements, but sometimes I do, and you can always go back and look at them. So I imagine that's the common consumer experience. I mean, we all know, like, the notice and choice model is like the emperor is naked of the privacy world. Like, most people don't actually read through each terms of service agreement with great detail. So maybe less time than Will on Twitter thinks has actually been spent reading these things. But that I don't know that invalidates their utility entirely, to have regulations in place that require them to exist.
Yeah, I think Will asked that in jest, or I hope he wasn't asking for a serious answer, because we probably don't know. But I think he hits on a fundamental truth for startups about the consumer experience, and that is, when you add a layer to actually accessing your service, the amount of users that stay with your service drop. And so we talk about, this is going to be a broken record, you're going to say, this is the guy that talks about disparate impacts between large companies and small companies. You know large companies, you've used them before, you're willing to click the boxes and read the notices. You come across a startup that provides a service that sounds like maybe you'll use it, maybe it'll be beneficial, but then you have to click through all these things and read this notice. Startups in our network, when they implement these sorts of measures, they see their conversions drop by 50% or more, just the amount of people that initially were going to, clicked into the thing and then decided, never mind, I'll go use something else. And so that's an unfortunate consequence for startups, and I think that's something that we have to think about. When you say that the emperor has no clothes, well, we should figure out how to solve for that.
Yeah, I would say this is like a great privacy job interview question, kind of like, how many golf balls fit in an airplane? Like, this is like, I'm stealing this question. But what I would say is, I shouldn't even admit this, but like, I get so annoyed by them. It's not even a matter of clicking deny or accept now. I'll just accept the screen being gray and having the pop-up just stay there and scroll down and read the context. Maybe that's like, I don't know, maybe it's just easier to click deny. But I would say this is a good point for America and the United States Congress to consider as we're implementing it. Is that what the model we want in the United States, or we'd rather look to a more structural and solution? Not to say there's no value of notices. I think there is some value, but should we follow the GDPR's model? I would say no.
I'd like to see if we have any questions in our in-person audience.
As one of the average consumers, you folks probably today don't have time to get into it, but I'm always struck that of all this sloppy data protection that's out there, it gets into the criminal part, and I'm not even quite sure what the dark web is, but I know that much of my data is there, and I think a lot of it got in there by the big hacks at the basic credit companies, and more recently, T-Mobile, people like that. But a couple of questions that may sound naive. I'm curious, I don't remember hearing ever, even though I get warnings every day on my internet about all the dangers that I have to do to protect myself, I don't know ever who goes to jail for this. I'll bet you not one person from Meta went to jail for that huge fine. How do we look into that thing? And then the other question is, how big is the industry that's out there protecting us from all this danger that I am supposed to give money and time to every day when I look at my internets? And how much are they actually lobbying to keep the mess going and blocking Congress from doing effective protections for both individuals and especially small businesses, which you made a good point, and even large businesses?
So I, if you don't mind, I love your questions. And I actually get asked on a daily basis, I run a cybersecurity team. Why does the cybersecurity team own the data privacy and consumer privacy issues? And I think this is exactly why, because it's one thing to regulate around collecting data, but we need to make sure the data we do collect is secured. Because if it's not, we see adversaries using it, like China, just as one example. We see criminal actors and a host of other issues that can lead to identity theft, future crimes, future cyber incidents. So it is a mess. And I think that's the real risk. If you are not in a regulated industry, like HIPAA with healthcare or GLBA with finance, largely speaking, you don't have rules surrounding how your data has to be secured. So you can freely collect it, and there's no safeguards. There are some exceptions. The FTC may come after you if you've said that you are protecting it in a way and you're not, you don't follow reasonable security. But generally speaking, there's no baseline. And I think that is, to me, was the selling feature for a privacy law in the US, is that there would be data security safeguards and what they call administrative, technical, and physical. All that meaning is you do have to have measures in place that are appropriate to safeguard the data you do collect. Because the fortunate reality is data breaches have went up, and unfortunately they are becoming more severe, and we've seen this actually happen in real time. Just with Russia, I know this isn't a Russia-Ukraine panel, but we've seen Russia, maybe both sides, but mainly Russia has been amassing this super sensitive data to target individuals in the conflict, going after for either disinformation or for physical violence. So this data does have value outside of just being annoying because somebody's sending you spam mail. So I see it as an urgent issue.
I can piggyback a little bit onto what Brandon said. To your specific experience, I'm revisiting my former life as a private practice attorney doing privacy and cyber work. Did a fair amount of incident response, and the way that our system is structured is there under state law, which usually governs data breaches, unless you're in a federally regulated space. Typically, there may be civil liability attached to an entity that's behaved negligently in securing its data, but in terms of who goes to jail for this, we only attach criminal penalties to the attackers, to the advanced persistent threats, to the criminal actors who are actually, trying to break into the data. And generally speaking, those people are often not in reachable places. It depends on the problem. It depends on the breach. But, you know, this is the difference between a state data breach law that may have a negligence requirement, may have a personal damages element to it if a company has behaved badly, and the federal Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which is what would actually apply criminal penalties to unauthorized access to a protected computer system. That's, I know for many people, likely including yourself, that's an unsatisfying answer, right? And that's why I think a lot of the more recent federal proposals have included not just sort of more classic data privacy and data protection issues like consumer right of access, consumer right of correction, but also provisions dealing with security obligations. Appropriate technical and organizational measures is the phrase to steal from the GDPR, but as my colleague here alluded to. It's a major concern, and as you mentioned, I don't think it's going anywhere. Once your data's out there, to some extent, it's out there, and there's only more data breaches. Yeah. So.
No, great point. Sorry, I didn't want to cut you off.
Oh, no.
Real quick, I didn't want to fully discredit. Like, our law enforcement community is doing a wonderful job. Like, we do see convictions occurring by Department of Justice against Americans, but to your point, it is largely foreign actors. So this isn't in jest. We see cases being brought against individuals that are in China and Russia carrying these out, and they are convicted, but then, the logical next step is, okay, well, they can't come to Disney World. I think that was how the media put it. Because if they don't come back to the U.S., China's not going to voluntarily give these people up. So is it even worth it? It's good to go through the legal process, but it's not giving the satisfaction a lot of people want.
We are running short on time. I know this is a conversation that we could keep going and many, many other questions to get to. But just to wrap up, I'd like to give each of our panelists, 1 minute to ask, 5 years from now, if we were hosting GDPR at 10, what do you hope would have changed and what do you hope would still be the same? And I'll start with Nathan.
All right. Well, I hope that in 5 years we're not talking about 10 years of GDPR, but maybe, I don't know, 4 years of a U.S. standard, celebrating the ways that maybe we actually got this right. That's pretty optimistic, but I think that's something that needs to happen for startups like those we work with. A uniform federal privacy framework that works for startups is something that's really needed. That's one that creates uniformity, promotes clarity, limits bad faith litigation, accounts for the resources of startups, and really recognizes the interconnectedness. We talked about large entities and small entities. It really recognizes the interconnectedness of the internet ecosystem.
Lee?
Although it would force me to change the focus of a lot of my current research and writing, I really hope that in 5 years from now, maybe we will have finally put this EU-US data transfer question to bed, and we will have arrived at a diplomatic and political solution that everyone on both sides of the Atlantic is, if not happy with, we can say that it represents what looks like a good political compromise where everyone is mad. that would be my hope for the next 5 years.
Yeah, I actually largely agree with both of them. I think I would just really further the point home of why we need a U.S. data privacy and security law now. Industry's at a loss, consumers at a loss, security's at a loss, our international standing's at a loss, innovation's at a loss, and so on, without this law. I know Congress is putting a lot of time and effort for it, but I think it is time we finally move it forward, and hopefully we'll be reflecting on what does a U.S. privacy law look like 5 years later in 5 years.
I know a lot of this conversation has been a bit retrospective, looking back on what's kind of happened in the aftermath of GDPR. I look forward to continuing the conversation with our panelists and with our audience in terms of what we may see looking forward, both in terms of U.S. and EU actions. If you could please join me in thanking our panelists for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.